When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Snapple. Want to know another Snapple fact? The first hot air balloon passengers were a sheep, a duck, and a rooster. Ridiculous. Check out Snapple.com to find ridiculously flavored Snapple near you.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Underrated Movie Podcast. I am your host, Derek McDuff, and today we're going to be talking about a film that is underrated. As the name might imply, this is a show that talks about films that are underrated, underappreciated, and ones that have slipped under the radar and passed most people by. And that film is, of course, Walk Hard: The Story of Dewey Cox. But joining me is I have a great guest today, a TikTok star, an audio technician, a master of sound, and that is Austin Olivia Kendrick, returning guest to the show. How's it going, Austin?
It is going great. Thank you so much for having me back. I love this movie. I love getting to talk to you guys, you know, last time. So, like, getting to be back and talking about this is such a joy. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I am really glad to have you back. I feel like, you know, I mentioned how, you know, you're an expert in sound, and you're also an expert, I think, in music and things that are vaguely Bob Dylan adjacent.
My dad raised me on a lot of Bob Dylan, a lot of music of this era. So it's very appropriate. I have, you know what? I have a theme here that's been established and we're following it.
Yeah, it works out. I'm glad. You know, just incidentally, my other film that I'm going to cover in March is also a musical film.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we're going to talk about Sing Street on the next episode. So,
ooh,
yeah,
yes.
But that's what we're talking about this week. This week we're talking about Walk Hard, which is, of course, the 2007. It's a fake biopic film, but it's done very earnestly, treating Dewey Cox as a real person, played by John C. Reilly. Of course, the film is directed by Jake Kasdan, son of Lawrence Kasdan, of course, the director of Empire Strikes Back. And it was written by Jake Kasdan and the guy who wrote every comedy movie from about 2005 to 2012, Judd Apatow. So, yeah, Austin, you know, unlike last time when it was a huge blank spot for me, this is a movie that I watched all the time in my teen years and then in my early 20s, too, of course.
Really?
Yeah, so I'm a huge fan of this. So I had this one earmarked to cover for a while, and you agreed that you really wanted to talk about this. So why did you pick this one?
Well, it's funny because, you know, the last time I was here, we're talking about Inside Llewyn Davis, and that was a film that I was so, like, you just described, like, you've been watching it for years and years and years. I only watched this film for the first time, like, a year ago. But it was one of those films that was always on the list, always kind of in the back of my mind. And then one day I was like, well, let's just finally watch it. And it is such a gem. For me, it's something where it's rare to find a parody film, something that's kind of a satire, especially of this kind of era, that feels, like you were saying, so earnest. And that has a lot of, you can tell from the amount of references, just a sheer amount of references that they make, even some that are incredibly meta, that they didn't just do this film for the sake of, like, yeah, this is an easy thing for us to make fun of. It was done with a lot of care. Mm-hmm. And you can tell it's done by people who really do love music of this era, as the film is set at anywhere from the 50s to 2007, is the end of the film. But you can tell that the people who wrote it, who directed it, who everyone in it cared very deeply about music of those eras, and not only how that music evolved and how it involved various personalities and various musicians, but also music as it evolved through pop culture and as it evolved through film. It is to find a comedy film, a satire film, a parody film that has that type of love in it, that has that type of nuance and care, is very rare to find. So that's why this just immediately stood out to me as such a gem, and something that I now love going back and rewatching and telling people to rewatch as well, because it's also just straight up hilarious.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is so, so funny. Like, it's a movie that, you know, me and both of my brothers used to just, like, watch all the time. Even my mom, who is, like, you know, she's, like, a woman in her 60s. She just, like, cracks up at it. My dad thinks it's so funny. And I don't care who you are, whether you're any of those demographics. Just, it's just, like, them saying cocks over and over again is just never not funny. Like, there's it's so dumb, but it's so good. And it's never, like, haha, wink, wink, we're saying this dirty word. It's just, like... It's like, it'll just, and sometimes there'll be things in the background, like, it's like, I noticed this time watching when he has his Dewey Cox show, it's like, the Swingin' Cox Dancers, and I'm just like, it's just dumb stuff like that, but the movie itself is such a brilliant parody. Like you said, it's never a, like, shallow or, like, lazy parody like all the ones that kind of became popular around this time that, frankly, kind of died out, you know, like the Scary Movie Imitator, like you know, the ones that came from that crew, you know, like the Starving Games and like superhero movies, like all these movies that are just like, hey, look at this trope, and they don't really have anything interesting or new or funny to say about it. They just like do the same thing, but like do some kind of like slapstick humor on the top. But this one, they clearly went the extra mile and like watched a lot of music biopics. You know, this comes out just a couple years after both Ray and Walk the Line, which I actually watched Walk the Line for the first time in anticipation of this episode, and I was like, I've seen already the first half of this movie because it's very much Walk Hard, but I think that in general it's just the most formulaic subgenre, the music biopics, the cradles to the grave type thing, where you have like all these beats, like the tragedy at the beginning, once again, both Walk Hard and Ray, his brother dies in some kind of horrific tragedy, and this, they crank that to the extreme with the machete fight, and just covers their entire life, and they've got to do this thing and the rehab and all this stuff, all these beats you see, to the point where when I was watching Elvis last year, and I was just like, or I guess 2 years ago now, I was like, I've seen this movie before. This is like Dewey Cox, you know? And I think if Dewey Cox had been more popular, you know, if it hadn't bombed the box office and been a movie that we need to cover on Underrated, I think it really would have killed this genre, because if everyone's seen Walk Hard, you're like, you watch the Queen movie or whatever, and you're just like, this is the same shit, you know?
Yeah, no, this movie walked so Weird the Al Yankovic Story could run. I don't know if you've seen Weird
the... I have.
Yeah, exactly, where it is this genre especially is something that takes itself so seriously. And it's something where it's almost become so seriously to the point where it's become cliche. And that's where this is a very fun space to get to play with comedy. To get to play off of those cliches and to, you know, find those little moments. This movie leaves no stone unturned in terms of finding spots for humor. The physical comedy of it, the recurring bits, the way that he is he's always pulling a sink out of the wall every
funniest thing in the world.
It makes me like cry laughing every time. Every time he walks in on his bandmate trying a new drug and he's like, you don't want any part of this shit, you know?
Meadows is so good in that role. Oh my gosh.
Underrated performer in general, Tim Meadows. This movie is also just jam-packed with so many incredible performers. I feel very strongly about the fact that we as a society let John C. Reilly down by not having him, not creating more roles where he can sing. And I know you're saying, like, Austin, at this point in time, musicals had very much fallen out of fashion for film in the mid-2000s. How could we have done it? I don't care. We should have just gotten around it and done it for John C. Reilly. He genuinely is an incredible singer. And the actual music written for the film is not only incredibly clever and, again, finds those spaces for humor, especially with, like, Let's Duet, but, like, A Life Without You is in a regular rotation for me. I think that song is a banger, and he does such a good job on it. So I feel very strongly about that. We let John C. Reilly down.
No, we really did, because like you said, he's a really great singer. Other than this and like Chicago, I can't really think of stuff where he gets the opportunity to sing really. And
Yeah.
like you said, the songs in this are all fucking bangers. Like they are so good.
And like, who gave them a right to be this good for this movie?
I bought the CD for this thing. I listened to it all the like, the one for me was Guilty as Charged. I like they're all great, but like I listen to that shit all the time. Like that is such a banger. And they really do a good job of not only like making good songs, making funny songs, but really imitating the different artists and eras that they are like trying to feel like. Like there's a lot of Johnny Cash in this. There's a lot of, like that scene where they basically do I'm Not There and he's doing the whole like Bob Dylan thing. I thought that was so great. And you're the Dylan expert, so I wanted to ask you about that. Like, that when they actually even seen, I just remember like the trailers and stuff like that for I'm Not There. So that's why I didn't get to watch for this. But I don't know, how did you feel about that whole section?
Well, that's the thing, is I think that so many people think that, and obviously Walk the Line had the most direct influence kind of on the framing of this story, and it's very much draws on Johnny Cash. But the thing about this film, like you were talking about, it references so many different musicians, and it moves through so many different eras, and it the way that the film itself, it has pastiche of Don't Look Back, of Bob Dylan, of Bob Dylan's, documentary films, of those clips of him being interviewed by reporters and him having none of it, and even like referencing in doing pastiche of Yellow Submarine,
Yeah, I was gonna
the Beatles
say.
animated, film that's like when he's on the LSD trip. Again, it's those little things that show like, oh, you weren't just, if it had been a one-to-one direct parody of Walk the Line, I don't think I would be nearly as fond of this film as I am. But seeing like little references to different musicians like Bob Dylan, like John Lennon, like Brian Wilson, like Jim Morrison, and watching him kind of almost put on the like wear little bits of their personalities as the movie goes on, and as it reflects not only in, again, in the aesthetics of the film itself, but also in the music as he's trying to evolve and as he's trying to, work his way through stuff. And it's also great to have one of those songs just be complete wordplay on wanting to fuck, for lack of a better word. I don't know if I'm allowed to swear,
Oh
but
yeah, swear to your heart as much as your
again,
heart
Let's
wants.
Duet is so clever and funny and so dumb. And I don't know, I have a very dumb sense of humor, so I think that that's why I like
Same here,
cry
same
laughing
here.
at it.
It's smart dumb humor though, it's like it's dumb, but in it's like it's done in a like a really cleverly written way where the joke is really just like ridiculous and anyone can get it. But it's a lot of times it's subtle and it's just or it's over the top, but in just like a way that is just like when they're licking the ice cream cones. Like that's so dumb, but it's so good.
And it's also something about the way that they, again, musical biopic films have become very known for the very like self-serious, and the way that they bring that same energy, that type of drama, that type of dramatic, like to lines like, this is a particularly bad case of someone being cut in half. Like of just like the way that they deliver such ridiculous and funny, they deliver such ridiculous lines with such sincerity and such drama is what elevates it to being so funny. There's never a moment where it ever breaks and goes like, ah-ha-ha, wink, wink, like almost like turn to the camera, wink to the audience, being like, we're in on the joke. It's like it takes itself so seriously all the way through to the very end. And when I said earlier that they leave no stone unturned, that they really pack in as much comedy as they can, all the way to the last minute. They insert after the credits are over, they insert a clip of quote unquote the real Dewey Cox from 2002, which again is just John C. Reilly, sitting there. And again, the way that it commits to that bit all the way through from beginning to end is why it works and why it doesn't feel like other, like you were talking about, like Scary Movie, like stuff like that, that it it makes it stand out, and it gives it that complexity, and it gives it that, I don't know, that edge of cleverness. It doesn't feel cheap.
Yeah, no, absolutely not. Because it, like you said, it never loses that conceit of like, this is a real guy. We're making a movie about him. And just like all the, you know, all the real biopics are like, they're either, they have to get the rights from, to the music from the, like either the person or from their surviving family or whatever. So it feels like, yeah, this is just like a story about this person and how great their life is. And they just kind of keep that very serious conceit. It's like the Airplane thing. Like, everyone in the Airplane is just delivering their lines completely straight.
Exactly.
There is no, like, there is no jokes. There isn't, like, or there are jokes, but there's not, they're like, to the characters in the movie,
it's serious.
They're not jokes.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And that's how it is in this too. And like I said, there's that post-credits scene. There's even like a, because I had the DVD, and there's even, if you watch the bonus features, they talk about like, oh yeah, like John C. Reilly is there, like talking about like, oh yeah, I had to go meet the real Dewey and like ask him, kind of have the rights to play you. And they're like, yeah, and he had a biography, but it was like, we were a bunch of drafts in, we realized that the biography was a bunch of lies. Like, even on the bonus features, they like fully commit to this bit. And the fact that they never ever break makes it that much more incredible and funny.
It's the reason it works. It's the reason the whole film works, because everyone is fully bought in, fully committed, and that's what makes you buy in, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And it's, you know, it's one of those movies where, like we said, like, not enough people have seen it, but I think, like, I've never heard anybody who's like, oh yeah, I don't like Dewey Cox. Like, everybody who watched it really loves this movie, and whenever you recommend it to someone, they always crack up. And I think that what you said earlier about it is kind of Walk the Line, but it's not entirely. You know, you, if you like me, I hadn't seen Walk the Line until probably, I don't know, like 10 years after seeing this. And so nothing, not having seen that, or not having seen Ray, like, nothing ever took away my enjoyment from that. I still got it because I knew music biopics. I knew this formula that's so ingrained in all of these movies. And I think that is a way in. Other parody movies, if you don't get a certain movie, if you don't get a joke, you might not be fully bought in on that movie. But this one, because the tropes of these movies are so universal, if you've even seen one, you get it. You understand exactly what this movie is going
for. And there's even, you know, there's so many jokes and meta references that may even fly over people's heads, but again, when you do catch them, it does show how much genuine love and affection they have for this entire area of pop culture. You know, one of my favorite things in the film, and it's a tiny little thing, is just the fact that they cast Jack White in a cameo to play Elvis. And that is very meta, because Jack White is like one of the world's biggest collectors of Elvis stuff. He literally bought Elvis's like very first demo tapes. He like spent a bunch of money just to preserve them. He is very fanatical about preserving Elvis's legacy. And does he look like Elvis? Absolutely not. Does he sound like Elvis? Absolutely not. But having his presence there, specifically playing Elvis, shows that it's like, oh yeah, no, there's a connection here between this person and this pop culture icon. So yes, we're going to bring them together. And yes, it is my favorite of between Jacob Elordi, Austin Butler, and Jack White. Yeah, Jack White's taking it. Again, does he look or sound like Elvis? No, I don't care. I don't care.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the must not take yourself too seriously and 6-1 since that matters. And what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
And he's doing the Elvis impression that we all did as kids. Was like, oh god, man, I'm gonna watch out. You know, it's the thing that like Elvis is like the easiest impression to do. Like anyone could do it, and so they're like, yeah, just like we'll get Jack White. And I think that the casting in this movie is really great. And they've said that they kind of intentionally miscast or cast against type to like add to the humor. And I love that stuff, like that stuff that they do when they'll be like, he's standing next to Frankie Muniz, and he keeps saying Buddy Holly.
His full name.
He keeps saying it over and over, just so to remind you, because it's like, yeah, that's what they do in music biopics. And, you know, it's not just with the names, too, that whenever they'll be like, oh, we're here, like, they in the 1960s, mm-hmm. it seems like a lot of things are changing. Yeah. This is a really turbulent time for America, yeah. You know?
It's... When it comes to casting, I mean, there's no better scene. And that, by the way, they go uncredited. They are not listed. But the fact that they have... When there's a scene where he goes and he meets the Beatles, and they have Jack Black playing Paul McCartney, Paul Rudd playing John Lennon, Jason Schwartzman playing Ringo Starr, and Justin Long playing George Harrison. And at no point do any of them ever actually attempt to do good... Liverpool accents.
Yeah, they're doing the Yellow Submarine voices is what
exactly.
They're doing.
But there's something about the absurdity of them playing these really iconic characters in pop culture whilst doing these like not they don't take that seriously. You know, it's more about while still also remaining entirely self-aware of like the fact that they keep throwing in references to the fact that Paul and John at that point at the Beatles' career were fighting a lot. Like they get into a literal fist fight. It's something where, again, that kind of dissonance between like, yeah, Jack Black is playing Paul McCartney and we're aware enough of what was actually going on with the Beatles that we are going to reference it directly. That kind of
And the guy just yells out, "Beatles, stop fighting here in India!" Like I think it just knows exactly what
exactly.
it's doing.
And so again, it's that type of love and care and notice of details, and also the dumb humor on top of it. That dissonance is makes it way funnier, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think they are some of the one of my favorite parts of the whole movie. Like. For years, I would just do, like, a quote-unquote Ringo Starr impression, but it was actually just my impression of just, like, Justin Long, or,
Schwartzman.
Sorry, who
Jason
was it?
Schwartzman.
Schwartzman. I always get... Schwartzman, yeah, it was just my impression of Schwartzman in this movie, because he's just, like,
I do think that Justin Long playing George Harrison genuinely got the closest to any of them, but the fact that he's sitting there with a sitar... You know, that George is the one sitting there with the sitar. Like, it's, again, the little details. It's that little bit of knowledge and care and putting that in. It's what separates this movie from the other films of its era. I know we've said that, like, at least I've said it, like, a dozen times at this point. But it's something that can't be stated enough. This is one of the reasons why this was the film that I wanted to revisit. That is because it is there. This... kind of era that the early to mid 2000s were so chock full of these parody genre films, and this one just stands out because of that level of detail and nuance and care that elevates not only just the script itself and the movie and in all of those little details, but makes it funnier. You know, it elevates the humor itself, and that's what makes it stand out for me, and why it's the thing I go back to amidst that sea of genre parodies.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we talked about how great it was that he was able to cast all four of them. And I think that's one thing, too, is the fact that you are getting this as a height of his powers, 2007 Judd Apatow movie, is that the cast in this is just stacked, where it's like every scene, a great character actor or someone doing a cameo or something, or it's to the point where it's just like, oh, cool, here's Jane Lynch for a scene. Or like, oh, Margot Martindale is the mom, you know, or it's just like all of these things. Like, here's Ed Helms for a sec, you know, all these, just, you know, Kristen Wiig there at the beginning as his 12-year-old girlfriend, which is just so funny. You know, Jonah Hill shows up uncredited, too, as like the ghost, the Return of the Jedi ghost of his brother. It's tough.
And for me, I've come to realize within the last year that I really love any movie that features David Krumholtz. And so I forgot that he was in this movie until I rewatched it recently going into this podcast. And I was like, oh my God, David Krumholtz. He's like one of those barometers of like, if he's in a movie, I'm probably going to like it. And this passed that with flying colors.
Yeah, no, that's a good, I think, yeah, that's kind of how I am with Margot Martindale. Like anytime I see her in something, it's like, you know, it's that joke that it became a joke. she's so iconic in this kind of role that it became a joke on BoJack Horseman of like beloved
Actors,
character
yeah.
actress Margo Martindale. You know, like she could be like a badass like handler on The Americans, or she could be like the goofy person in this.
She has the range.
She's always gonna
she
kill it.
She has the range. Mm-hmm.
And then also I want to shout out Raymond J. Barry as the dad, who I always recognize him as like Jack's grandpa on Lost. But he's so good. Like him, the whole thing about like wrong kid die, you know, that's another thing that's just that's so ingrained in like biopic. Like obviously that was in like Walk the Line, where you have, you know, Robert Patrick, who is great, but he's doing the same like the same grumpy character in a much less funny, like tongue in cheek way. But played almost exactly the same. It's even something that comes up, and I don't know if you saw Ferrari, but there's like a line in Ferrari where she basically at the and this is not a spoiler because it happens at the beginning of the movie, but like you find out like Ferrari's brother died when they were kids or something, and the mom basically says wrong kid died, like almost verbatim, and you're just like it just takes you out of the movie because you're just like Walk Hard,
yeah.
You know? Even in non-music biopics. The tropes are still so powerful.
Absolutely. And but yeah, it's something where, and again, him especially, we touched on that kind of the serious delivery of these ridiculous lines. He's takes that to the nth degree. And that's why the performance works. And even getting through so self-serious is like to the very end when he accidentally slices himself in two with the machete. And he's just like, oh, I've sliced myself, and like it's inherently ridiculous. His legs are still standing next to him, and his other half of him is on the phone. It looks like a Looney Tune cartoon, and he's delivering with complete sincerity of like, "I was too hard on you," and you know what, son, it's again that the absurd silliness contrasted and juxtaposed with that incredible sincere serious delivery that just elevates it and makes it so funny. It's so funny.
Like, yeah, and there's the moments, like, you know, obviously he's quote-unquote smell blind, which is obviously playing on the whole Ray thing, and the moment when he gets his smell back, it's such like it's really funny, but it's also like kind of uplifting.
Yeah.
And like you're like you're just like happy for him when he's just like smelling the horse shit. And he's just like, I love your horse shit. Oh, it smells so bad. It smells so, and you're just like, you know, and Jenna Fisher's there, and it's I don't know. It's really, really funny. And I think that another trope that this plays on really well of the whole music biopic thing is the whole cradle to the grave thing. It's like we've got to tell this person's
entire life story.
And they even say that in like the beginning, it's like Dewey Cox has got to think about his entire life before it goes on stage. And so it'll do things like somebody will say, and it's something that I keep thinking about in the, because there's the trailer for, it'll probably be out by the time this episode is out, but or I guess it's already out, the Bob Marley biopic, which seems to be playing on a lot of the same things. But there's like in moments in that trailer where he's just like singing his lines, and it's like to lines to songs, but he's just like talking about them in daily life. And that's another thing this movie does so well, is just like somebody will say guilty is charged. It's like, that's a song. It's like, don't leave me. That should be a song. That's a good song. Like just these little moments where it's like these things, which, you know, clearly, you know, a lot of these artists, the creative process is a long drawn out process, but you got to do it in a 2-hour movie. So you just got to have someone say a thing, and then it just cuts to them live on performance doing in the next scene.
And it's even like one of the more ridiculous ones. And I say this with such affection for this movie. I love Rocket Man. It's probably my favorite of the actual musical, you know, music biopic.
I would agree. I would agree with that, honestly.
Very hot take, and I'll be very vulnerable with everyone here. This is one of my hottest takes. I think the Oscar that went to Rami Malek for Bohemian Rhapsody should have gone to Taron Egerton for Rocket Man.
All right, well, we're on the same page
there.
Good. Because I'm a huge Taron Egerton fan.
You understand me, thank you.
Yes, even in Tetris, I thought he was great.
Taron Egerton stand to the end. But one of the most ridiculous, it's almost played for comedy in the context of Rocket Man alone, but when he's in the office, you know, and like about to be like trying, like he's playing the piano, you know, and he's like, what's your name? And he's like, Elton. And he's like, Elton what? And he looks to the wall at a picture of the Beatles, and a single light shines on John Lennon's face. And he goes, John, Elton John. And it's like, It, that moment was almost tongue-in-cheek in Rocket Man, but it's because, like you were saying, in previous musical biopics that have come out, it's those moments where people will say, like, again, these really iconic lyrics or these really iconic song names, and they're just like, yeah, that's it. Like, this moment definitely happened in real life where this person said this thing and it immediately became a song. Yes. It immediately, this very fundamental thing to this artist was just happened upon. It's so good.
Yeah, it really is. And I think honestly, the music, you talked about how we both like Rocket Man a lot. And I think the reason that movie works a lot better for me than most of these kind of like Cradle to the Grave music biopics is because it has a different spin on it. It has that it's an actual musical in it. It's not
it
just
comes
like,
from a point of view, and it comes from the artist's point of view. It's not about an objective outside observer looking in on Elton John's life. It is how Elton John, the lens through which he viewed his own and what his internal experiences were like. And like you were saying, it's very much a musical. The way that the songs are incorporated, they're not necessarily diegetic him in a concert hall playing, you know, or in an arena or a stadium playing to an audience, but these internal experiences and how they relate to what he was going through, and these they're instead presented within these dream sequences, you know, that give us that kind of perspective of where he was at and what he was dealing with, what he was feeling, and connecting those really iconic songs to those specific moments in his life. Even going out of the way of even one of the diegetic moments when he's playing the troubadour and he starts playing Crocodile Rock, they even have the moment there where he starts floating and it becomes fantastical because that's what he's feeling. It's his lens. Then that moment, it is going so well for him that he quite literally floats off the ground. Did that happen in real life? Absolutely not. Yeah. But that's how he felt. And that is what it feels. That's why Rocket Man felt so fresh. That's why Rocket Man felt so different, is because it had a like you said, it had a spin on it. It had a point of view. It had something to say other than here's a Wikipedia page list of just like, here's all the events that happened in this artist's life. And then that's it, you know, without any actual introspection into that artist.
Exactly. And that's why I think I generally don't like these music biopics, is because they are really lacking it. And whether it be because they're just trying to appease the rights holder or whatever it might be, a lot of times it is, like you described, a Wikipedia page. And the ones that really stand out, especially in the wake of Walk Hard, which I think, like, it might not have had as big of an effect, but I think that people did see it, and I think it did affect, maybe some people were like, we've got to change up this very, very clearly parodyable formula. And the music biopics that have been great are the ones that break away from it, like Rocket Man, or like something like, I don't know if you've seen Love and Mercy, but I think that is an absolutely fantastic movie, because instead of being like, what's the entire story of Brian Wilson's life? It's like, we're going to focus in on two very important, very specific moments in this guy's life that will help you understand him. And like, you know, like you were saying, like, it's very internal and very much about like what he was going through. And it helps you understand his life much more than like just a list of all the things he did. And that's why something recently, you know, like an Elvis or something like that, it doesn't work for me, because it just feels like we're doing the Walk Hard thing just again.
And I mean, you know, touching on again that I believe it came out the same year as Walk Hard, but I'm Not There, which is technically like, that's Todd Haynes' film. Like, it technically isn't a Bob Dylan biopic. It's this weird experimental thing where they kind of touch on these various, they plays on these various personas that kind of Bob Dylan had, and like the different kind of public facing characters that he inhabited at different points in his career. And that, even if it's not, again, them saying like, this is Bob Dylan and this is directly what happened in his life, that's a much more interesting take, because it's actual commentary on like what this artist actually presented to the public and that relationship and the way that he had to morph between those different personas throughout his career. And so again, I'd much rather take that over the Wikipedia article. And I mean, it's a... I don't want to go too hard on Bohemian Rhapsody. I love Queen.
Yeah, you can.
Okay,
you
is this
can.
A safe space?
Yeah, I mean, I love Queen too. This is a safe space. We're allowed to talk. The editing won best editing for some reason, so we can say whatever we want about
Thank
it.
Thank you. And like you mentioned at the beginning, like, you know, this kind of like era of music, the 60s, 70s, especially, that was, my dad was always had me that type of music on. And so it's something where I grew up with that stuff. I have a deep affection for like things like Bob Dylan, for Johnny Cash, for Queen. And again, I say this with the utmost love and respect to Queen, but like the Bohemian Rhapsody kind of feels like the encapsulation of that type of Wikipedia article outside in perspective. And it's the joke of the rest of like that Freddie Mercury was spinning out of control partying and the other members of Queen were like, no, we stay at home and are faithful to our wives and we never party or do anything bad. And it's like, guys, come on. I understand. But like, if you're going to go to the lengths of making a piece of art, putting a film out there that is meant to tell a story of, again, a character that is not even, that is at the same time, a real person that exists and a character that exists to the public, just do something with that. Do something mm-hmm. instead of just like, and then this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened, and then we didn't do anything bad ever. And then, you know, and it's, there's a lot of validity in wanting to see art that, again, tells the story of these artists that have produced stuff that make, that mean a lot to us, that sincerely connect with us. But it's always disappointing to see when they take the formulaic easy way out instead of actually giving us any sort of new insight into who that artist is or what their internal world was like, or again, that type of dissonance that exists between when you're a public-facing figure who is beloved and has that parasocial relationship with the audience that, you know, makes them popular, that dissonance between that public-facing persona and the person that actually exists on the inside. I think that there's a lot of missed opportunities out there. So I love to see mm-hmm. when people are willing to make a swing and to actually explore that type of, I don't know, perspective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. And I think that, you know, the luxury that this movie has that a lot of other music biopics don't have is the fact that it is based on a made-up person. Mm-hmm. So they can just kind of do whatever they want. They can be ridiculous and make Dewey look bad in a lot of scenes mm-hmm. and just do whatever. And, you know, you brought up Bohemian Rhapsody, and I think that's one that was hit the hardest by the actual band yeah. kind of interfering.
Doing a lot of revisionist history.
A lot of revisionist history, and then even stuff like I brought up the editing. One of the reasons that movie is edited so chaotically, it's not because the editor was bad at their job or anything. It's because there was like a contractual thing where they had to show like each of the members
equally.
The same amount of time. Yeah, so that's why you'll have Freddie Mercury doing something. Like, no disrespect to Brian May or any of those guys,
but I think if you
make a music biopic about Queen, you kind of want it to be a Freddie Mercury story.
Yeah.
You know?
Especially given that he mm-hmm. passed, you know, at this point, it's been nearly 30 years, you know, since he
yeah.
passed. And so
yeah.
he's been kind of enshrined within pop culture, like crystallized in amber. Mm-hmm. And with his, you know, with how much persona he did have, with how much charisma, how much stage presence, and also the fact that he was like a queer man, and that mm-hmm. type of is of course it is going to be more interesting to people are going to want to kind of dig their hands into his story, especially given that it had such a tragic ending and he died far too young, and also amidst the context of him dying of AIDS, and mm-hmm. and again, you know, being open about that at the end, and you know, that is the much more interesting thing that people are going to want to dig into versus the rest of Queen. And again, that's with the utmost love, Brian May. I, you are incredible. It's, but yeah, it's something where it is a bit, you kind of have to be self-aware of that, you know?
Yeah. Cause apparently they, like, originally they wanted the movie when it was still like in early development, they wanted the movie to keep going after his death, like after Freddie Mercury's death, and to like have like 30 more minutes of movie. It's like, no, that's clearly, yeah, exactly. It's clearly the conclusion to this, that story, you know, that has to be where it ends. That's the story beat. And I think that that's why it makes sense that a lot of these movies end on that big, and they do a lot of times that revisionist history where they're like, okay, the Live Aid concert would actually happen at a different time. Mm-hmm. We've got it for dramatic purposes, have it here. And then they do a really great job of just like in the they make the closing text of this movie so funny, which is usually just like an afterthought. It's usually just like Ray got clean and that everything was great, or like it's Johnny Cash proposed to you know, her, and then
Elton
they got married
clean. He found true love. Yeah. He started, you know, and he's been touring forever, you know.
Yep. And this one is just like Dewey Cox died 3 minutes later. It's so funny. And it's so good.
Again, they found every little beat they could to get that humor in, and it hits. And it's so funny because, again, like it has that kind of that very cliche final song montage of looking back at his entire life that we've already just kind of sat through the whole movie looking at, but we're gonna look at it again through montage and look how far he's come, and you know, and so, and then coming to the end of it, and then like, yeah, he dies 3 minutes later is so them sticking the landing. It is such good setup payoff. It's so funny.
And I love that the montage even kind of plays on the idea that a lot of these stories are exaggerated, are just kind of larger than life, because most of that stuff in the montage is stuff we either haven't seen at all, and it's like, did he really deliver Tim Meadows Baby, or it's just like stuff that is like exaggerated, like instead of ripping one sink off the wall, he just goes down the line and is just ripping sink after, which is so, like, to bring up Elvis one more time, there's a scene where Elvis is like he's quote unquote, he's middle Elvis, you know, he's like the lowest he's ever at, and he goes into a bathroom and stands by a sink, and then when he didn't rip it off a wall, I was like, I was so taken out of the movie, honestly.
You were like, missed opportunity. Missed opportunity.
Yeah, I was like, what is happening here?
Missed opportunity for a Walk Hard reference? I would never. Yeah. I would never. Oh, God. Yeah, it's... I appreciate, and I know that we're here today to talk about this film as it stands alone, you know, and how much value it has just standing alone, sitting down, turning it on, and enjoying it for what it is. It is elevated and becomes even richer, and my appreciation for it grows when we kind of connect it to its broader, the broader implications it has in the way it connects to not only, like we're talking about, musical biopics, its trends, its cliches, and how it finds humor in playing off of those things, but also, again, the type of love and appreciation that went into it, you know, and all those little references and all that stuff. And I find myself appreciating it more and more as I kind of almost like widen my lens as to where it's situated culturally, but in terms of pop culture, in terms of music, and in terms of film.
Yeah. Yeah. Very,
I hope that didn't sound too, I don't know, douchey of
me. No, because I completely agree, right? Because it's like, you know, that scene with the machete fight, right? That's inherently just really funny. Like, somebody gets cut in half with a machete and then is, like, half a person on the ground is, like,
Again, like Looney Tunes.
Yeah, exactly. It's ridiculous. It's funny. That's just funny. But if then you know the context of, like, oh, yeah, like, Ray has that scene where his brother dies in the water bucket, or, like, you know.
Yeah, and Johnny Cash has, his brother died in a freak, like, what, Saw accident?
Saw, like, and his dad's, you know, like, where were you? And he's like, I'm like a kid, what are you talking, like, you know, when you have that context, when you know those things, it's so much funny, you know, like, this is a funny movie, but if you know who the Temptations are, for example, that's gonna hit different, that's gonna be really, really good. So, I guess you could probably go in with seeing one of these. You could honestly watch this movie without ever having seen any music biopics. I think it'll still hit. Yep. But the more you've seen, the more understanding and context you have, you realize that all of this really dumb humor is actually incredibly smart, like we were saying before.
It's what, incredibly informed.
Yes.
You know, again, the references to John Cash and June Carter, mm-hmm. and the way that their relationship started, and that, like, with them bringing in Darlene, you know, and the whole, like, back and forth, and the whole kind of, like, again, it's just the dumb, over-the-top humor of, like, no, we can't, when she goes up and kisses him and then slaps him in the face, like, I'm not that type of woman, we can only be friends, and they get close again, she's like, slaps him again, like, no, we can only be friends, and, like, again, that dumb humor, that coming from an informed place of the reality. Again, like you were saying, you could go into this film not really being familiar with anything of the era, of the specific references they're making, of you could have no idea of Brian Wilson's plight of trying to get Smile made and him kind of having a breakdown after Pet Sounds. You could have no idea of that context, mm-hmm. and still the sequence where he gets to where Dewey Cox gets to a similar spot and is overthinking these songs and he's making the jokes like, no, I want another, you know, whole section of didgeridoos and I want all these things. And one person's like, this is like five songs on top of one another. That's still funny. It comes from an informed place. And when you know that the origins of that informed place, you appreciate it more. Mm-hmm. But even without it, it's still they still find ways to make it funny. So it's not a film that isn't accessible to people who are unfamiliar with the genre or unfamiliar with the source material or unfamiliar with the references. And that is a fine balance to strike. You know, it is a very, very difficult thing to pull off. And this film does it so well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think today people like to just talk about this era of comedy with, like, a little bit of just, you know, they look down their noses a little bit on it, especially, like, the whole Judd Apatow things. And, because, you know, there was always this, these were the movies that were very, very popular at this time. And I think that, you know, they don't really get made anymore, but, and I think maybe people are just starting to miss them a little bit now. But at the time, it was just, like, this was, like, the lowest common denominator stuff, because it was, you know, it's so, on the surface, very stupid, you know, just, but there's something so funny, even if you don't have that Brian Wilson context, about him just yelling, I want an army of didgeridoos. That's so good. And there's so many just great, iconic lines that me and my brothers, that we haven't watched this together since we were all in our, like, early 20s or something. But, like, you know, we'll just quote this movie constantly to each other. And do you have any like favorite lines or anything from this one?
Again, I just love the sincerity of... that when the doctor at the beginning is like, this is a particularly bad case of someone being cut in half, and then, like, him explaining, like, his upper section has been separated from his lower section, and the dad's like, in English, damn it, we're not scientists. Just, like, again, like, this, it's so dumb, but it's so funny. And I feel like I've come to a point, like you were saying, you know, very much this during this period of, like, the mid to late 2000s, where people were starting to sour on this and starting to look down on it. And, you know, we're now looking back and almost appreciating it more. One of the things that has I feel like I felt in the last few years, I don't know if it's just, like, a general movement or if it's just me growing up, of being like, you know what? It's okay to just laugh at things that are dumb funny, and I'm not going to feel bad about that. And I'm not going to feel like it's beneath me or anything. I showed my husband the movie Hot Rod. He'd never seen it the other week. Oh. And it is just, again, the epitome of just dumb, weird, dry humor. And I was, like, crying my eyes out laughing. And I'm at a point where I don't care if it's quote-unquote dumb humor, if someone wants to say it's beneath me. There's value in me still going back. If it goes back and it makes me laugh, I'm not going to think... I've unburdened myself of the idea that I need to justify enjoying that. It makes me laugh. There's value in that. And that's it.
Yeah, I mean, and also that's kind of one of the... I mean, I cover all kinds of movies here, but, like, one of the things is just, like, if you like it, just like what you like, you know?
Yeah.
There's going to be movies out there that, you know, people might look down on or whatever. But if you think that it's good, just enjoy it, you know? You don't have to like things because they're on, like, the AFI top 100 list or they got nominated for Oscars, whatever. I know, especially in the last couple of years since I've been like a podcaster and a film critic, like so many people who are just like, oh, well, you like that movie? It's just like, yeah, it's good. I enjoy it, you know, whatever.
Yeah, one of my favorite movies of all time is Monty Python and the Holy Grail. That is nothing but dumb, weird humor at start to finish. And that was a movie that goes back to childhood with me. That was one of my dad's favorite films. And so there's something about it. Is it considered lowbrow? Sure. It has a lot of meaning to me inherently. I watched that a lot with my dad when I was a kid. It brings me back to those memories. And also it just makes me laugh. Sometimes you're just having a bad day and you want to put on something that's going to make you laugh. It's going to make you feel better. And if there's a film that does that for you, I think that's worthwhile. And I don't think it's worth casting aside into, like, you know, a garbage bin of like, you know, this isn't cinema or this isn't film. Maybe this is just my trauma from film school coming out and talking. I think that actually might be it. But I still, regardless, feel very strongly about that. You know, there's moments of comedy in this where it just comes from guys being hit in the nuts. I will still laugh at that. It's still funny to me.
It's very funny, you know, and comedy is very subjective, but like there's some things that I think like physical comedy stands the test of time. That's why a lot of the comedies from like silent films like Chaplin, those guys, all those moments are still really funny.
Yeah.
You know, there's some stuff that just like inherently just gets to humanity's funny bone. And for whatever reason, like someone getting hit in the nuts is always going to be funny
it's
to
evergreen.
Everyone.
Like it's evergreen. Yes.
It really is. I just have a question for you.
Okay.
It's just why do you think this movie is underrated? Like, why do you think it didn't hit when it came out? Why did it underperform at the box office?
I think, like we kind of touched on, it got lost in the shuffle of, again, like you were saying, those kind of Judd Apatow films were really kind of felt maybe a little oversaturated at the time. And it didn't matter the merits of the writing and execution and detail work of this film, or just, again, how funny it is. I feel like people were just that association with the name and with that kind of bloat and that exhaustion of it just kind of left people to cast it aside and to just not see it for the sake of like, I've already seen like a bunch of films like this and I don't want to, not realizing how much care went into it and just how good it was. And I think it's something that has become something of a cult film. I would argue it has cult film status.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Yeah.
Like you said, where it's like, I've never come across a single person who's been like, yeah, I don't like that movie or I hate it. You know, and every person like I direct towards it always enjoys it. And it's something where I'm glad that it is getting a cultural reappraisal and just a reappraisal as a film itself, and as a piece of cinema. Oh my God. Again, the film school trauma leaping out tonight. Oh God.
This is a safe space. Like I said, we're all friends here.
God bless you. But no, I think very much the best thing that could have happened for this film was the cult film status that it has achieved, because now it is so beloved. And even if it did kind of, if it was written off at the time in the moment that it did hit the box office and the moment that it did hit theaters, I'm glad that it is still had a second life and is now being held in such kind of high regard for a comedy film.
Yeah. Yeah. Because this movie, you know, at the time, like we said, it didn't do well at box. It didn't even, like, it did okay with critics.
Yeah.
It did, but it has, like, a 74% of Rotten Tomatoes, which is, like, that's not bad, but it's not that good either.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, I think that it is one that over the years, especially as these music biopics kept coming out, people, it really grew in a lot of people's estimation, and people showed it to their friend. They're like, oh my gosh, you've got to watch this movie. It's so funny. It's one that I feel like it hasn't really been streaming a ton, and it never had like a real big second life on, like, you know, a lot of these movies would end up on like FX or something, and it never, I don't think, really had one of those lives either. And I was thinking about too, like, why was this film, you know, so missed by everybody? And I think, yeah, maybe some of the film critics, like you said, just kind of looked at it like a stupid thing.
Just like one in a pack, you know,
yeah,
that they had already written off.
Exactly. And one thing too that I think that maybe why general audiences is kind of missed out on is because this is right in the era of John C. Reilly and Will Ferrell doing their thing.
I was gonna
and
say,
I love all of those movies, but this comes out right between the year before is Talladega Nights, the year after is Step Brothers, and this one is like at the time, I think Will Ferrell can probably is a big enough name to be like, here's a Will Ferrell movie, but I don't think John C. Reilly, he's kind of like seen as a package deal with Will Ferrell, so I think people see, oh, it's Will Ferrell's friend, but there's no Will Ferrell in this movie. And I think maybe some people skip it because of that.
Yeah.
Like, unfortunately.
Once again, we as a society let John C. Reilly down, and I will never, ever let anyone forget it.
Mm-hmm. And one thing I'll say, too, about John C. Reilly is, like, obviously, like we missed on him as a singer, and he's obviously, like, doing a comedic performance in this movie. I think we kind of... I miss John C. Reilly as like a serious actor.
Yeah, he was nominated for an Academy Award for Chicago, and his I love Chicago. I'm a theater kid. I love the movie adaptation of Chicago, and he is kind of my favorite part of it. His performance is absolutely incredible, and knowing that he had that. He has that in him. He has those chops. He has those. He can handle dramatic meteor roles, and the fact that we never got much of that following Chicago, you know, in terms of his career is disappointing.
Yeah, absolutely. And because, like, you know, you mentioned Chicago, he's also great, you know, he's in Gangs in New York. I talked about him on
Boogie Nights
when I did that. Boogie Nights, exactly. Like, which, like, he's so free. Like, I think he even has a joke in the Oscars about how he was both in Boogie Nights and Talladega Nights, you know. And so, yeah, he's just one of the most versatile dudes. And the fact that it's like there, you can't really see anyone else playing him who would be able to bring the comedy, bring like the raw, genuine emotions, even though they are played for laughs. Like, he is actually giving a great performance, and who just has the musical chops and skills, like to play the guitar and to like sing. Because like, as good as Jenna Fisher is in this, she's really good. She's not singing, but like John C. Reilly is singing so well in this. Like he like my dad who. He's a musician. Like, he was, like, in bands in, like, the 70s and stuff.
Oh, right.
And he's, like, yeah. And he's, like, wow. Like, he's really, so he's always just, like, you know, you hear that? That's the beat right there. You know, like, he's always going off on those kind of tangents. And he loves this performance in this movie. You know, he'll watch something, like, he'll be, like, that guy's not playing. That guy's playing. Like, he'll just, like, spot in. He's just, you know, it's the same way that, like, when I see someone in you playing video games in a movie, I'm, like, that's bullshit. You know, that's real. And so he has that same, and he really loves this movie, too. And he's just, like, and so he has that deep respect for John C. Reilly actually being musically talented.
And he does approach the role, like we were talking about, you know, everyone in the film commits to the bit, and no one takes it more sincerely. Like, no one committed harder to delivering on the role than John C. Reilly did. Like, the fact, like, it is played as a joke, both just inherent, just as it is, but also commentary on the way that musical biopics do this, of like the fact that he is playing the character at 14 years old when he is clearly 42, and they do, he's 42 years old. They do nothing to try to age him down visually. But the fact that he turns around with like this child's hope in his eyes, mama, you know, like, you know, and like he approached it with that sincerity. Again, not kind of a wink, wink, nudge, nudge, you know, break the fourth wall, like, haha, isn't it funny that me, a 42-year-old man, is playing a 14-year-old? It does. No, he just approached that moment in the character with sincerity. And he does it for the, he treats the character like that for the entire film. It genuinely is a character that is put through a lot, you know, like I said, it touches on a lot of different eras, a lot of different musicians, a lot of different things. And he truly makes he truly actually makes a character arc of it. It's a genuinely good performance of a character that goes through a lot, that grows and that has the hardships and that, and again, he finds those moments for comedy of dumb humor and of that dissonance between the sincerity of his performance and the absurdity of what is going on around him. But it feels like by the end of the film, you feel like Dewey Cox is a fully fleshed out character and like a real person. And it's John C. Reilly's performance that makes you believe that.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you talk about his arc, and I think it's such a perfect arc because it's you know, obviously played for jokes, but like when they have that thing, he keeps recurring thing about like, oh, I'm gonna like write this masterpiece, it's gonna like define my entire life, and you know, they have that scene in the 70s where he's trying to write it and it just keeps coming back up, and he keeps talking to his ghost brother and stuff, and then of course the last scene in the movie, like, you know, he's being honored and right before he dies he gets to give it, and it's like a pretty good song, but like, and then the lyrics are just like so, it's funny because like you're like, these lyrics are really funny, they're really on the nose, like all the things he's learning, he just like starts listing all these things, but it's actually like a pretty powerful, great song.
Yeah. Again, it feels very much like the biopic grand, you know, the grand last moment, the let's look back on everything. Right. You know, it rose to that occasion. And yeah, we failed John C. Reilly. He deserved so much better. and the fact that he always gave great, when you look at his career, he's mostly known for his supporting roles. And I think that's what also feeds into people not going to see this film like they would if, like you were saying, like they didn't see Will Ferrell. Like, oh, they're a package deal.
Right.
Where it's like he was never given the chance in his career to establish himself as just a person who could carry a movie on his own. Not because he wasn't talented enough. He clearly is. He carries this movie like it's nothing, which is an astounding feat, again, to balance that comedy, that sincerity, you know, to find that balance. It's a very difficult role to pull off, and he does it so well. But the fact that he was never given the chance to establish himself as like, yeah, I want to go see a John C. Reilly movie, you know, is something that leaves me so heartbroken. We let him down. We were given such a gem and we let him down. But you know what? You won't let him down if you go back and you appreciate his performance in this film.
Yes, exactly. And that's at the heart of it. Why I want to do Underrated is because there's so many actors and performances in movies that deserve to have a light shined on them like this one. And I'm so glad that there are other people out there that are passionate about things like Walk Hard. And that's why I'm like, as soon as, because I, you know, we were talking about when we would, and as soon as you were like, Walk Hard, maybe? I was like, yes. I've been wanting to talk about this movie for so freaking long. It is so, so good. So, you know, before we wrap up, you know, on that vein, are there any other music biopics that you think people should watch that are maybe a little underappreciated, or even if they don't even have to be underappreciated, just what's one of your favorites?
I will say, I touched on it earlier, but the feels like the successor to this film, if you have not watched Weird, the Al Yankovic Story, I know it's on like the Roku channel, and it was technically released.
This is like a Roku original, yeah.
It was technically released for television. If you get a chance to sit down and watch that, it is so incredibly funny. So good. And it's something that doesn't capture the accurate story of Weird Al Yankovic, but it captures his entire point of view as an artist. And I feel like that has more value in something like that versus, again, the kind of Wikipedia style approach. Obviously, again, I mentioned touched on Rocket Man and I'm Not There. Are some of my favorites as well. Yeah, I kind of, those are the first that spring to mind and that I can't recommend enough because they have a point of view and commentary on the artist's point of view as a person and as a pop culture figure.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. Weird, I think it does feel kind of like the natural successor to this movie. You know, I don't think we're the first people to you know, point out the parallels between them. And, you know, like, even down to, like, I think the cast, like, the stunt casting in both these movies, you know. I think it's really well done in both. Even like, even Daniel Radcliffe as Weird Al kind of feels like it's just an extension of that Frankie Muniz as Buddy Holly joke.
And the fact that he got just so ripped for it, like, just physically jacked to play Weird Al, incredible. Yeah. You have what, like Conan O'Brien playing like Andy Warhol and stuff for all these little cameos. Oh, it's the spirit of this film lives on in Weird, the Al Yankovic story. Can't recommend it at all.
Yeah, and then absolutely. And I also have the second Rocket Man. I love that movie. Like, and you know, you mentioned Taron Egerton. obviously great. I gotta shout out Jamie Bell for a second.
Yes.
Jamie Bell is a guy who I think if he was 5 inches taller would be one of our biggest movie stars.
100%.
But like I think like people just like don't know what to do with like he I don't know. Like he's just somebody who's been really just like we failed him, I
yeah.
think, as well. Jamie Bell. Rocketman's great, and then you know, I mentioned Love and Mercy. Mm-hmm. One I'm actually gonna try and watch is because when I was doing this doing all this research on music biopics. When I didn't really know that much about, but I'm going to watch it, is... Have you ever seen Control? It's the Joy Division movie?
Okay, no.
I'm really... Yeah. I am very fascinated to check that. I might report back next week.
What's it called?
Control.
Control. Oh, after the song. Oh, my God. When was that made? Oh, 2007?
Yeah, so same year as this one.
Okay, that's fascinating. Because
yeah,
I,
and it's,
as someone who's a fan of both Joy Division and New Order and spent too many years not knowing that the two of them were connected, admittedly, again, we're being vulnerable here tonight. But yeah, I didn't even know that existed, so I got to add that to the list.
Yeah, I guess, yeah, it's pretty much just about Ian Curtis, so it doesn't go into any post-Joy Division.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I'm you know, that's one I didn't really know about either, so I'm... I only found out about it just doing the research for this, so I'm very, very curious about that. But yeah, Ian Curtis, obviously, it's about apparently, you know, it's one of those ones too. I think probably could maybe be covered at some point on the show.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know if you ever like look at like those sites that'll tell you like where things are streaming, but like anytime I see this, it's like streaming on like all of the free places. It's
yeah.
on like Tubi and like Freevee and mm-hmm. like Hoopla and like you're just like okay. Interesting. It's one of those movies that's really slipped through the cracks, at least rights wise. So.
Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, you know, I guess that about wraps it up. Unless you have any final thoughts on Walk Hard here.
I don't think so. I think y'all have listened to me ramble and enough. thank you for giving again. Thank you again so much for having me and like for giving me a space to ramble. It's so fun to do this and talk about films that are. I feel like. There's less value assigned to comedy films than drama. And so to kind of create space where we can actually dig our fingers into to a comedy film that does have the kind of substance behind it that rarely would be given space to actually explore that substance. The fact that we have you give me the space to do that here with you is such a gift. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for doing the same for me, for allowing me to do this thing where I get to talk about these movies that I love so much. And, you know, finding someone else who loves it just as much as I do is always awesome. But yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's just thank you for having me. I'm just glad to ramble with other folks that like the same things I do.
Definitely. And, you know, I've appreciated you coming on here and allowing me to ramble as well. And if anybody wants to hear any more of you, you're on TikTok, aok.wave,
yes.
A TikTok star. What can you tell the people about that?
I don't know about star. as was mentioned kind of at the top of this, so I'm a professional sound editor. I do a lot of dialogue and ADR editing for TV shows, professional union. And I accidentally kind of accumulated a following on TikTok talking about sound in film and TV, its history, kind of talking about some of my favorite films, my favorite TV shows, you know, on the sound front, the different techniques we utilize in our field, you know, to kind of make that end product. So if you want to hear me ramble about all things sound, find me on TikTok at aok.wave. Yes, I made a sound pun with my handle. I have no regrets about that.
But yeah, I would say, you know, if you're like me, somebody who just loves film and loves learning as much as you can about film, absolutely follow her on TikTok. I do. Whenever I'm scrolling and I see you come up, I'm just like, okay, I know I'm going to find out something interesting now. It's always something I didn't know before, and it's always something that really fascinates me. So
yeah.
Definitely check her out, guys.
Thank you. I absolutely love what I get to do for work. I love my job more than anything. I love sound, and so getting to talk about it and get people as excited about it as I am is such a joy and such a gift.
Yeah, I'm glad to receive it. But and then also if you guys are interested in hearing any more of me, you know, I do a couple other things. I do another podcast with my friend Damien. It's called the Midnight Film Society. That one is more of a what's come out recently type thing, where we review more recent things or talk about the Oscars or whatever it might be in the film news. So do that. Also, there is a Patreon for this podcast at underratedmoviepodcast.com or patreon.com/underratedmoviepodcast, where you can go to underratedmoviepodcast.com. There's a link to it there. And then I do two bonus podcasts there. There's one on sports films that I do once a month called Underdogs. This month, we just talked about The Sandlot. And then there's also Infinity Stones and Dragon Bones, which talks about Marvel films, which I recently moved over to Patreon as well. And we even talk about stuff like Madam Web. So I'm really curious to see what that is all going to be about.
I will be tuning in for that episode. Absolutely.
Okay, thank you. But yeah, and then, you know, you can check me out on other places. Like, I write for Film Threat. I do stuff for Watch Mojo. And then you can check me out. I've guested on a couple other podcasts recently. One that I wanted to shout out as well is check me out on Cinema Jaw. That was a really fun episode because I got to review a couple films and also count down my top 5 favorite screenwriters.
Ooh.
So check out Cinema Jaw. Yeah, that was a fun episode. I had a lot of fun making that list, you know, after I've read so many books on screenwriting. It was finally nice to, like, put it out into the world, my thoughts. But yeah, that was all a lot of fun. So check out all those places. Links to all of my stuff, to all of Austin's stuff, is all going to be in the show notes. One more time, Austin, thank you so much for coming on and talking about this one with me.
Once again, thank you for having me.
All right, guys, I'll see you all next time.